everybody. Thank you so much for coming out today. My name is Hannah. I'm a bookseller at Porter Square Books. I'm very happy to be moderating this panel. And here are our lovely authors.
I'm Jen. Most people know me from my romance books. I wrote Some Girls Do, Hot Dog Girl. But most recently, I have gotten into psychological thriller and horror with The Last Girl Standing.
Hi, I'm Andrew Joseph White. I wrote Hell Followed With Us and The Spirit Bears Its Teeth. I feel like if I don't mention the whole New York Times bestseller thing, that's a breach of contract or something. I write gross stuff for kids.
Hi, I'm Alex Crespo. My debut novel, St. Juniper's Folly, came out in June. It's a queer YA haunted house book, and I have another paranormal spooky sapphic cryptid hunting book coming out in early 2025.
All right, so are we ready? Let's get on to the questions.
Let's do it.
So I'm curious, first of all, what made you want to write young adult queer horror? What was the thing that kind of dragged you towards the young adult portion of horror or the horror portion of young adult? Anything that speaks to you about those genres that made you feel like this is the best way to tell my story?
Okay, I'll start. I feel like something that I really love about horror and YA combined is that there are so many experiences for teens and especially for queer teens that feel so heightened and so intense in your adolescence. And I think horror gives you this really unique lens where you can really honor those big feelings in a way that feels authentically horrific to the way that a lot of teen years play out for people. So that's something that I really enjoy, and I think that it kind of helps put a spotlight on how dramatic that period of time can be in your life.
One of the things that always stood out to me, when I was a teenager, I found a list of the 100 most disturbing books in the English language and dedicated myself to reading as many of those as possible. So when I decided that I wanted to start writing, I was all right, I want to write for a 16-year-old me because, if I had figured out that I was trans earlier, things might have been a bit easier. And also, I'm a really gross human being. So I was all of those books that I read as a teenager, it would have been really cool if they were for teenagers. So I'm just going to do that, actually. And it hasn't gotten me in trouble yet, so we're just going to keep doing that.
My answer, you two pretty much covered it. I fell in love with horror very young, when my uncle gave me Pet Sematary when I was a third grader. He thought that the misspelling meant that it was for children. I guess it didn't matter what word it was or what the cover looked like. And so I always knew, and so horror has been a massive part of my life, and so I always knew that I wanted to kind of write for teenagers once I finally took the leap into that genre. And I just love everything when you're a teenager, it's your whole life is ahead of you, but everything feels like the end of the world. And in horror, I get to play with, in a way I don't in my contemporary romances, is your whole life ahead of you, though? maybe not.
That's so real.
And Jennifer, I have a follow-up question for you. Since you're historically mainly a romance author, mm-hmm. did you find any challenges or any hurdles you had to overcome when switching to horror? And also, can we expect more from you with the horror?
I would love to keep doing horror. We'll see what happens. My graphic novels are tend to be paranormal monster of the week. I've done Witches with Coven. This coming fall, I have Full Shift, which is a sapphic werewolf romance horror. I think there's definite changes in that I'm so known for romance. The audience expectation is you're going to have a good time and everything's going to work out. And I just want to remind everyone, there's like machetes and men in animal masks on the cover. So it's, you know, it's not quite, you know, Hot Dog Girl, but it's just horror and, you know, being terrified and being in love are like my two favorite things on earth. So it just made sense to like explore them and combine them in interesting ways.
I love it. And I'm curious if any of you have any like ritualistic writing practices that like help you get into that kind of mood to write.
If I don't have my music loud enough to do eardrum damage, then it's not loud enough and I can't focus. That's mainly it.
I'm the exact opposite. I have to write in complete silence.
Oh, I die.
Also, I can only write if I sit down and write for like 4 hours straight. So I can't do like little pieces here and there. I have to do like full immersive experience, which isn't really conducive to like having a social life or good mental health. But
that's so
we're out here anyways.
Yeah, I always start by building a playlist that I think my main character would listen to, and that gets me kind of into it. And then when I was drafting The Last Girl Standing, I was simultaneously drafting my adult romance debut. So I would take a break for lunch, and so in the morning it would be like people kissing and all of that, and then I would go eat lunch, and then I would come back, put on a different playlist, and be like, all right, murder.
I love it. And these are all very powerful stories. I'm curious where they started. Like, is there anything, like an event or anything that just inspired you to be like, I need to tell this story? Anything like that?
Mine kind of like came out of a daydream, honestly. I feel like when my mind drifts, I'm like taking my long commutes and stuff like that. I'll just end up thinking about like different paranormal scenarios. I really like paranormal podcasts, so I feel like I was just thinking about like twists on a haunted house story for St. Juniper's Folly, and I ended up kind of like just thinking of this single line of like, what if you walked into a house and then couldn't walk back out? Like, why would that happen? How would that play out? How would a rescue go in that situation? And also, if you've read St. Juniper's Folly and you know the kind of like big plot twist around that and around the house and all of that stuff, that was my immediate answer to like, why would that happen? So I had the full concept in mind and I kind of just went from there.
Your book is really cool and I like it a lot. Gosh, thanks. When it came to The Spirit Bears Its Teeth, my usual go-to is like, what is the worst possible thing that could happen to this particular kind of person? So obviously, if you are an undiagnosed autistic trans kid in Victorian London, the worst possible thing would be being sent to an all-girls school that's trying to kill you. And especially one that's like trying to make you into a perfect little girl. Yeah, no, that would, no. So I was like, that would suck. That would be awful. All right, let's go.
For The Last Girl Standing, I had been, you know, there's been so much stuff going on in politics, and I had watched people that used to be people that I considered very like rational and enlightened people kind of fall down these weird rabbit holes of like QAnon and like all of it. And suddenly they were really believing in very, you know, just you could find any truth. You could put any truth you wanted together because you're so bombarded where you're going to find somebody who believes what you believe. And so The Last Girl Standing starts with the aftermath of two girls who have survived a summer camp massacre. And so they're trying to figure out why they survived. Is there a reason why they survived? And as they uncover more and more about what happened, the main character, Sloane, starts doubting the truth. And it turns into one of these scenarios where you don't know. It's such an unreliable narrator. And she's finding things to back up any theory that she has and doing this kind of spiral slide where you don't know, like, is she discovering the truth or is she just falling down this horrible rabbit hole where the truth is she survived because she did and there isn't a greater reason. And so that's kind of what it came out to, with all these people who were trying to put together truth in like these almost absurdist ways that I'm like, surely you don't believe that, but they do. And so I was like, well, what if it was like a teen girl who was already kind of floundering and survived something horrific? I was like, let's take political trauma and make it emotional trauma instead. You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm curious how you each feel queerness fits into the horror genre, because I personally work at a haunted house and everyone's gay. It's so, it's literally the queerest genre I feel like I can find. And I'm like curious how what do you guys think about that?
For me, I just think, you know, growing up, I'm a little bit older than you two. And so growing up, I mean, not that it has gotten 100% better, but queerness was always coded as the villain or the monster. And so that's who I had as a role model growing up, and especially getting into horror so young and figuring out my own queerness. And so to me, it was just like almost like reclaiming, or where you felt like home, because that was the only representation that I had when I was younger, was like, you are the monster. There is something wrong with you. There is something different. And I'm like, I am going to be the best monster I can be. And so I think, certainly people my age, that's why I see so much queerness in that. Is that still for you young hip kids the case?
I mean, it certainly was, like, for me, and it was also for me a combination of, you know, I didn't know I was trans, so I couldn't connect to myself. I didn't know I was autistic, so I couldn't connect to other people. What do you have left? Monsters. Yeah. And that was really all I could ever go with. And then on top of that, body horror is just so trans. It's so good. The human body is a sack of meat. It's what you do with it, which is why there's a 2,000-word C-section in this book, for children. It's just horror and queerness. Just really, it's fun. It goes to, and it's so cool. That's my real answer. It's cool. I like it.
It's cool. And queer people are cool. So
yeah, it's like I'm gay and I like it. So obviously,
yeah. I think for me, like, I see a connection between fear and intimacy. Like, I think fear begets intimacy in really, like, visceral, intense ways that I think appeal to queer people uniquely, and me specifically. And I think that, like, so often horror, especially, like, legacy horror, is queer by accident because of that, like, intimacy that happens because of fear. Like, I've been watching the Saw movies and, like, Adam and Lawrence and, like, Hoffman and Strom. Gay, so gay, like so gay. Obviously gay. And like, it's funny how even if it's not written as queer, like horror feels so queer at times because there's just like these intense connections that are happening between people.
I love that.
I knew you were going to say Saw before you even, yeah.
I know, I can't stop talking about it.
That was a great answer. Thank you guys. Those were all great. And I'm also curious if any of these, like, characters in these three books, are any of them to you, like, a little bit of a self-insert slash, like, your favorite? Or, like, someone you had the most fun developing?
Loaded question.
Would you like to answer that?
You're stewing.
Yeah, okay. So Silas, the main character of The Spirit Bears Its Teeth. Yeah, so we're just going to grab like a 16-year-old kid who doesn't know that he's autistic, doesn't have a word for it, and has repressed his transness so hard that he doesn't really know what he's doing anymore. So, and also on top of it has a really hard time relating to other people and doesn't have a lot of friends and has a weird sense of anxiety and is bad. Can I just underline bad with people several times? And also is into really gross stuff, but is like a baby. Yeah. It's honestly kind of, this is honestly kind of obvious now that I say it out loud, because I didn't intend to do that, but apparently I can only write the same person over and over. I don't know. I love Silas. I'm not going to take back anything that I did, but yeah.
I definitely, like, I feel the same. I feel like Jamie is, like, teen me dialed up to 1,000. His little, like, angsty vibe, the humor to cope with all the stuff that he's going through, and then being, like, a total softie on the inside, like, more so than Theo and Taylor in that book. To me, I feel like that was just, like, carving out that segment of me that existed for a small period of time when I was a teen and, like, putting it in that book. So he's me a little bit.
Yeah, I think I always put a lot of myself in the characters. Sloan is definitely kind of embodies the like lostness and aimlessness that I felt as a teen when I was trying to deal with a lot of my own identity stuff and things like that. And so I kind of combined that with, I was drafting it at the start of all the like shutdowns during COVID. And so it became this place to like really put my dark feelings where I could then like shut the laptop and walk away. So there's a lot of all of that like time period in life and how I was feeling about things is definitely really like woven into the character for sure.
Love it. Awesome. And are there any trends in horror that excite you, any that you applied to this book or excited to use?
Well, summer camp slashers are certainly having a moment this year. There's been, there's three, I think, that are recent that are all queer. But I am just excited to see horror being so embraced in the young adult community, and it's like, I am always able to find something new to read, which wasn't always the case. So I'm just hyped for really all of it, and I just want everyone to keep doing it.
My go-to is like marginalized / like overly political horror, which mm-hmm. is my favorite. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so good. There have been some attempts at movies that I haven't really 100% clicked with. Like, ugh, they slash them. Don't get me started. But just every time I see horror being used in an overtly political way, I'm like, yes, mm-hmm. yes, here we go. This is how we do. I'm always so excited for it. I'm trying to think of anything in particular, but I think the thing that keeps coming back is My Heart is a Chainsaw.
Yes.
Which is probably like, and also the only Good Indians. Stephen Graham Jones is so good.
Yeah.
So if you are a fan of that sort of thing, please pick up his work. It's amazing.
The audiobook of The Only Good Indians is like probably the best audiobook I've ever heard. No offense to all my amazing narrators, but like that book, that audiobook, did you listen to it?
I listened to it My Heart is a Chainsaw as an audiobook.
Terrifying, beautiful. So check it out.
Yeah. I feel like my answer is a combo of both of yours, which like diverse horror, seeing different types of stories pop up is really great. In particular, I love seeing people like incorporate their cultural background into horror, especially for Latino authors, mm-hmm. like brujeria and like stuff like that. Like there's a certain mysticism that comes with our culture naturally, and seeing that, you know, be brought into books is really great. And then also in terms of seeing like the age range of horror expand, I love seeing middle grade horror now mm-hmm. because I feel like especially like young kids, everybody's weird in life, but like young kids are so strange naturally.
Yes.
And I think it's just one of the most darling things about kids is that they're like little witches and like mm-hmm. they're so interesting. And kids love scary stuff. And so seeing that actually represented in publishing feels really authentic and really cool.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, more than just Goosebumps, because I destroyed all of those in like a weekend when I was like 10.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like there wasn't anything else.
Yeah. Right. and I also love Stephen Graham Jones. He's awesome. And on that topic, do you have any author inspirations that stick out strongly to you, rather as a writer as a whole or for these particular novels?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. I just really love everybody working in the sapphic space right now is like my biggest hero. Like I love seeing that come out because when I was first, so my debut Hot Dog Girl was sold in 2017 and I was told by so many people and so many agents that queer girls don't sell and there's no market. The only market exists for like cishet white boys. And I had multiple agents before I signed with my agent tell me, make it a hot dog boy, make them be boys. And so for me, when I see any author that's coming out with queer women and queer girls, I am like super here for it. Kaylin Barron does like amazing work, a lot of like fantasy retelling. Cinderella's Dead is like in this amazing, but all of her books are sapphic and very black. There's no white people in them at all, which is very she gets a lot of crap for doing that. And so it's stuff like that. When I take my own queerness, I still have, you know, the privilege that comes with being white. And so especially when I am seeing, like, people of color writing these sapphic books and sapphic horrors and taking these big risks and stuff, I'm just like, I'm here for it. Those are always my, like, heroes and inspiration.
My main inspiration has to be, like, that list of 100. So I'm trying to think of, like, because sometimes when I say the names, people know what I'm talking about, and sometimes I get dead silence. So, like, Cows by Matthew Stokoe, Hog by Samuel R. Delaney, The Wasp Factory, Exquisite Corpse by Poppy Zebright,
yes.
Anything by
yes.
Poppy Zebright.
Yes,
Poppy. My editor at Saga, because I sold my adult book, found, like, a 30-year-old copy of Lost Souls by Poppy Zebright and mailed it to me.
Oh, my God.
And was like, this book was integral to me as, like, a young queer boy, so here you go. Read it and tell me what you think. So all of that stuff is very, I just like, I'm going to try and write that for children. not Cows, though. I don't think I could get with Cows. That book was a little much.
Yeah. I feel like I kind of go back to, like, more like classics or like modern classics and stuff like that for inspiration. So for St. Juniper's Folly, it was kind of, like, I feel like Jane Eyre was inspiration. Also, like, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. I'm rereading it right now.
It's so crazy.
It's so good. And I don't know. Also, like campy classic horror movies. I feel like my, like, sapphic cryptid hunting is leaning more on, like, classic horror tropes and stuff like that. So looking at the classics and getting inspiration there is really cool.
Yeah.
Would it be a surprise if I said that I can't do horror movies, like, at all?
I struggle with it. It's easier for me to read scary stuff because I can take things at my own pace and pause, but movies, I'm like...
Yeah, no,
I scary movies?
I can't handle... I can handle, I think... I've seen all of Jordan Peele's movies and the Pet Sematary remake. That's it. I couldn't get through the first Saw. I had to stop. And, of course, I love Saw. I love the Saw traps. I read about them. I'm on the Wikipedia. I'm on the YouTube. describing how, like, the reverse bear trap works. I'm reading all about it and put in a movie. I'm like, no. No, I can't do it. Can't do it.
It's so funny because I know, you know, I do a lot of panels with romance authors, and now I've been doing a lot of panels with horror authors. And it's amazing the amount of horror authors that are, like, a little bit squeamish or, like, can't do it. I watch a horror movie almost every single night, and I have probably for the last 10 years. I'm scraping the bottom of the barrel. Like, one time I was watching with my friend Rory, and we got halfway through, and she's like, I think this is, like, a student film. And I'm like, it can't be a student film. It's on, like, Amazon Prime. And she looks it up, and she's like, yeah, this is for his master's degree. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry, but when you watch 365 horror movies, you eventually get to the student films. I would die if I didn't. Like, if I go more than, like, 2 or 3 days, I'm like, oh, I need my, like, fix.
I almost cried moving a dead rat off my porch a few days ago.
Well, I would cry over a dead animal.
It had been there for a few days. And I was like, no, and all of my characters are, like, in my head calling me, like, a coward. I'm like, I know. I know.
The rabbit. would you advise, what would you advise young writers trying to build a publishing history or an author platform?
So I did my MFA in creative writing, and one of the classes that we took was called, like, the second year, like, seminar or something along those lines, and it was supposed to prepare us for publishing. And the entire time, I was emailing my classmates behind the professor's back going, it doesn't work like that anymore, which was probably the wildest thing I've ever had to do. He gave us, like, an example query letter, and I'm like, oh, God, don't do that. Like, because the query letter he gave us was someone who spent the entire time going, I'm so cool, you have to represent me, I'm going to be your next person. I'm like, stop. Why would you do that? So I think the largest misconception, I don't know if this is still around, but it was massive in my MFA program, is that you do not have to publish short stories to work up to publishing a novel anymore. That's not a thing. And I keep forgetting that in the old guard, that was, like, a thing. It doesn't work like that anymore. Most of the authors I know don't have a short story credit to their name. and it's like full length novels that they're putting out now. And every time that I explained that to my MFA classes, the professors looked a little uncomfortable. And I was like, there seems to be a thing where it's just like you write short stories and you put them in small pubs, and then maybe you get one in the New Yorker, and then maybe you'll catch an agent's attention and can put a book out. No, it doesn't work like that. So I guess the major thing is make sure that your publishing resources are up to date.
That is helpful.
Yeah, definitely. I like St. Juniper's Folly was the first book that I ever wrote, and then it was my debut. So I feel like I'm looking at it from the perspective of somebody who's like truly winging it. I feel like my, like you said, things have changed so much, but also just in the time since I got my agent, things have changed really drastically. So like you said, I think it's really important to like stay up to date. I know Twitter is god awful, but a lot of stuff in publishing happens there, and staying as connected as you can in terms of like visibility and stuff like that is really important, just because things do change quickly and like agents move or people get canceled, and like you just have to know what's going on because things change quickly.
Oh, and a major thing on top of that, I know networking is a scary word. It's literally just making friends.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's taken me further in my career than anything else, is literally just getting to know people online, being friendly with people. Just be nice.
And I have a disability that impacts social interaction, so if I can pull it off, you're fine.
Yeah, I think finding your community of other authors is one of the most important thing you can do as someone that's either looking to break into the industry or like newly in the industry, is to find your people, and networking. But the people, like the people that I debuted with, the ones that I really clicked with back in 2019 have become like my closest friends. Yeah. And so it's not necessarily about like, well, I need to like network with V.E. Schwab today and I'm going to like spam the people that are surrounding you and the people you're debuting with or the people you're querying with are the people who, you know, it's a very uneven industry. And so some of you are going to climb faster, some of you won't, but you'll all, you know, everyone has ups and downs. And so it's really important to not be like, well, I'm agented, so I don't have to be friends with queriers anymore, because somebody querying tomorrow could write the next bestseller, you know. So just jumping off your networking, just be genuine and be kind and stuff. But also know that in terms of like, you know, building a platform and things like that, you are limited in what you can do. It is really your publisher who can move the needle for you. And I think a lot of times as debuts, I know that I certainly did. Like, I was like, I need a pre-order campaign. I need to like pitch every bookstore I can think of. I need to like do all of this stuff. But there's only so much that you can do as one person versus what your team and your publisher can do. And that's important to know, because I had a lot of people who completely burned themselves out doing, you know, every blog that they could find under the sun, of which there are millions, and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, like, you're only human, can only do so much.
All right, so we're going to open up to the audience for questions in just a minute. Do you have anything to share before we do so?
Well, I have 3 books out next year.
Yes. Plug them. Okay.
You know, I am very tired. Yeah, so I am hitting you with another young adult romance in April. Which is another sapphic romance about a girl who wants to be a professional umpire, who falls in love with a girl who is trying to become like a professional baseball player. So they are breaking hearts and gender norms. And then I have an adult romance in May, which is another sapphic romance. About a girl who inherits a horse barn and a farrier who may or may not be based on K2. And then I have my sapphic werewolves in like August, September. So pretty much I can keep you busy. Thank you in advance for your pre-orders.
Speaking of pre-order pitching, my third young adult book, Compound Fracture, comes out next year. And it's about an autistic trans boy who may or may not be aerospec. He doesn't know. He's still figuring that out. Who is the great-great-grandson of someone who was executed during a labor strike in West Virginia and ends up getting brought into the blood feud between his family and the family of the local sheriff, who is the family that did it 100 years ago. And it gets really nasty really quick, and it's a lot of fun. And then my adult debut comes out in 25, and it's about an autistic trans man who doesn't speak because he hates you. and he ends up pregnant, and his boyfriend and the species of predatory alien worms they work for won't let him get rid of it. I cannot say anything else because there are children in the audience. but just know that it's a lot.
Your books have the best titles, though. Like, every one, I'm like, heck yeah.
Is You Weren't Meant to Be Human. And my editor is Joe Montietzaga, who also did The Only Good Indians. So I got really
lucky. Yeah. Nice. Wow, you guys had such, like, succinct pitches. buy my book. Buy the one that's already out. I do have a YA rom-com, No Spooky, Just Love, coming out next year. It's called Queer Senora. So if you're curious, if I can write things that are very gentle. I know. It's so cute. Yeah, if you want something cute from me, that exists, too. It'll be coming out in May of this upcoming
year. Let's do a romance panel next year.
I know.
We can re-meet.
All right. My thing died, so now Slubs gets to wear the headset. There we go.
I love it. All righty. Let's open up the floor. You right there.
Yes. So, like, how do you, like, deal with writer's block or, like, a massive bout of depression, and how do you continue writing through that?
So one of the things that I've noticed, we get asked this, like authors get asked this a lot, and when it comes to this point in your career, you literally cannot afford to have it. You have a deadline. Mm-hmm. You write even if you hate it. That's how The Spirit Bears Its Teeth happened. I hated that book until it was an arc. Like, I genuinely despised it. Surprise, it's actually really good. But I hated it. So much of it is if once you're under contract, you cannot afford to wallow in writer's block. You skip the scene that's getting to you, or you just do something else. At one point, I remember I deleted like 5 chapters because I realized that the issue that was leading to my writer's block was something I had messed up 5 chapters ago. And so there went, you know, like 10,000 words while under a 6-week deadline. We love this. So much of it is writer's block for a lot of times has a reason. And you can find it if you're willing to pick at it. But also if you just like, I know, for example, like a lot of my friends is like, if you have sometimes the writer's block is depression and it's like a mental illness. And that in that situation, it's very much a just give yourself some grace. That's really all you can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of agree. I feel like sometimes writer's block is external and sometimes it's internal. As in internal, like the issue is within the book. When I was writing my second book, I realized I had writer's block because of something that was happening externally in my life, and I solved my writer's block by coming out as transgender. Can't recommend that to everyone. It was a little dramatic, but it worked, and I finished the book. But usually, like, when it's internal and it's something that's in the plot, I'm the type of person where, like, I won't move on. I won't jump around. I'm like, if there's an issue, I pick at it until I can unravel it. And to me, it is, like, a little knot that you have to unravel if it means, like, making a list of every single thing that you're trying to accomplish in that chapter and trying to figure out what's not working. That's helpful, but also, like, if it is something that you're, like, struggling with your mental health, I think if you are not on deadline and you have the luxury of taking a break, I think that that's something that you should consider.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you both pretty much summed it up. If you're not on deadline, definitely just really take care of yourself and take a lot of time to refill the well. I am on a lot of tight deadlines pretty consistently. So I find myself powering through more often than not. But when I do have a minute of downtime, I am very big on like refilling the well, consuming. For me, that means consuming a lot of media, a lot of music, movies, books. Because for me, like input in equals input out. And so when I'm really struggling, a lot of the time it's like I haven't taken the time to kind of refill that. And I set different boundaries in my life. Like I get a lot of blurb requests, which are, you know, when they send you a book and they want you to say something nice about it, and it's like all those nice compliments you see on the cover. And so I make sure, for me, like my fun books, I always do audio, so my brain knows you can just relax and breathe, because a lot of times when I'm reading blurb books, even if I am absolutely immersed and super passionate about it, I'm like, what am I gonna say? Like, and I'm thinking of like how to sum up the amazingness of what I'm reading. And so finding tricks like that can also be really helpful, I think. Mm-hmm. Finding ways to turn your brain off and letting it know it can just chill.
So my question was, like, knowing how your subtext works in horror and how much of it is in horror, and like how some of the themes of horror are around queerness, how do you play around with
I haven't consumed a lot of like classic horror because I'm baby, so I might pass this off to someone who knows a little bit like more about classic horror than I do. Also, I'm 25, so like classic horror is mainly older than I am, and I don't watch movies all that much. So
I don't know. I know as like the resident old, I should take this one.
No.
I am the classic horror. I don't know. That is like a really good question. I mean, to me, I am just trying to queer up every space that I'm in as much as I can. So I don't know that I'm deliberately thinking as I'm working how I'm going to like play with that, as much as just having the queer representation is already doing that. Does that kind of make sense? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do you like...
Yeah, that's such a good question.
It really is.
Yeah, it's thinking like, I feel like when you're looking at classic horror and stuff like that, a lot of times the spookiness in there is like a big metaphor for queerness.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're writing queer horror intentionally, it's like the, like instead of it just being like an overarching theme, I think that like the spooky scary can be a much more pinpointed part of the queer experience, because you're also having these like lived experiences of the queer people in the book. So I think you can be more specific and be more emotive about like the elements of the queer experience that you're including, instead of just being like big gay theme, you know? I don't know if that makes sense. Cool.
Big gay.
All right. We'll throw it all the way back there to you on the left. Yeah, you.
So, in general, being queer can be hard, but particularly to me, being a trans autistic person is like literally a horror show, 90% of that. But in that, how, or do you, and if you do, how do you bring the joy of that kind of experience into even horror? Because like, even I just started reading a lot of horror because of my friends, but so I'm getting into it, so I know not every horror story does include happiness, but if it does, is there a way to kind of bring that positive side to those kind of experiences into your writing?
Yeah, I'm very much into, I'm the survival. It, the fact that you survive and make it through when a lot of times it doesn't feel like that is a really big thing. But also one of the things I really like to do with my horror novels is I always make sure that there are like little points of taking a breather in the middle of everything. Because not only does that get to highlight just like a reminder, it's like, oh yeah, these people aren't just vessels for trauma. They are, you know, they're queer people, they're disabled people, and they have like a sense of community in that. And on top of that, it also makes the dark stuff way worse.
Yeah.
So it's like you can really only have really dark shadows when you have some light. otherwise it's just all the same thing, and it gets kind of boring. But so much of that is based in the joy in the idea of survival, which is a lot of times really all my characters can kind of hope for. So.
I think another way that you do that is the connection, like with the groundskeeper and with Daphne. It's just like it takes you out for a minute, and it's like calm before the storm. Like having somebody to finally see you, even though like it's like a horrible situation, it was definitely like a breath of fresh air, you know.
I love the groundskeeper.
Yeah, he's so sweet. You back there?
Yeah. Good question. I feel like for me, I don't want to like spoil anything. Everyone relax. Okay. I feel like for me, it was a matter of kind of like putting that out of my mind, because in my head, I feel like if I'm writing like queer horror and stuff like that, there's going to be stuff that I'm subverting anyways. And I think that like this happens for a lot of folks who are writing queer characters in like darker contexts, that there's a voice in the back of your head that says, you know, like the media portrays queer people as villains, so I don't want to write a queer villain. And I like, at least for me, I can't, you know, speak for everybody, but for me, I'm just like, okay, well, fuck it. Like, I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear. I'm just like, I'm already subverting things, and I need to put the expectations out of my head and tell the story that I want to tell. But still being realistic and checking in with myself that I'm not necessarily perpetuating, like, truly harmful stereotypes. I think it's something that, like, it's not black and white at all. But yeah, I think that expectation to, like, portray all queer people as, like, saints, or, like, also make them all live until the very end, I think that that's, like, almost... Sometimes, at least for me, it feels like looking at things through a cishet lens, and I'm writing for queer people primarily, so I want us to be freaks.
Yes. Yeah. I definitely feel the same. I think, you know, when you're dealing with like bury your gaze and stuff in the context of the historical context of what that has been, I think just including this representation and queering up horror is almost a protest of that. And I also feel like, you know, I don't necessarily have the obligation. It's not like a monolith. It's not one experience. And surprisingly, I get a lot of this with my romances, because I write very complicated and messy girls. And a lot of people expect women to be like the caretaker and the mature one and all of that. And they're like, you know, you're writing these like... you know, my trademark is disaster bisexuals, and they're like, aren't you worried about that? And I'm like, no, like, as a disaster bisexual, this is the representation that I need in the world. And so I think that I have in the back of my head, you know, am I doing any harm? Or, you know, always I want to be like mindful of that and the kind of representation I'm putting out there. But I don't think that I have to live up to the expectation of writing just these perfect queer characters who, you know, even if something traumatizing, you know, like in horror, I have to get them through the other side in a better learning experience, you know, where there are better people, because, you know, life is really messy, and I like to show that.
All right, we can take one more question. Raise your hand wicked high if you want to be the one. All right. That's a pretty high hand right there.
Okay, for the last question, who is the gayest horror villain, like most iconic?
Oh. That's what we needed.
Can you
please? So for me...
Why is it Dracula?
Why is it... See, I'm going to out myself. Why is it Pyramid Head?
Stop! That was mine!
And it's not just because I think he's hot, okay?
He is, though.
Thank you.
Wow.
Oh, this is a whole thing. I have to introduce you to somebody who... I'll tell you later, but
wait,
yes,
wait, safe space for that statement, for sure.
This was the ideal space.
Eddie from Outlast. There we go. That's the actual answer.
Wow. Okay, I don't feel like he's a villain, but like Mothman? Like Mothman is a queer icon to me.
Mothman.
I am Mothman's biggest fan.
I recently went to the Mothman Museum. I had to drive back and forth over that like silver bridge thing and stuff.
What gets me is I'm from like my family's from West Virginia and I've never been to Point Pleasant.
Oh my gosh.
Field trip.
I have a daughter who plays sports and we had to go there she plays all over the country and we had to go there and the parents, like it's very weird because sometimes parents will trust me with their children and they went out to do grown-up things and left me with this group of like 12-year-olds and I was like, we're going to the Mothman Museum. It was a very eye-opening experience for them, but I think there's a great statue of it.
Mm-hmm. So handsome.
Yeah.
Sweet. All right.
Yeah, those are great answers. We'll stay with that.
Lovely. Nice. Thank you all for coming out today. Thank you to our lovely authors. Thank you. Oh, yes. And it's going to be right outside the door. Lovely. And we're going to set up for a signing now right that way. All right. Beautiful.